Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an examination of the almost certain military response to the apparent use of chemical weapons in Syria and speak with Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who worked for decades in Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. The author of a number of bestsellers, Robert Baer is now an intelligence analyst on CNN, and he joins us to discuss why military intervention in Syria is a bad idea, even if it is all but inevitable. Then we'll get a further analysis on a likely U.S. strike from Henri Barki, a professor of international relations at Lehigh University, who served on the policy planning staff at the State Department. We'll discuss growing international pressure on President Obama to act in response to the use of weapons of mass destruction and how a punitive political as opposed to military use of force will do little to change the outcome of Syria's agonizing civil war that the majority of Americans want the U.S. to stay out of. Then finally, we'll speak with Jesse Walker, a senior editor at Reason Magazine and Reason.com. He is the author of a new book, The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory, that traces the history of political paranoia in America and explores the reasons why people are attracted to conspiracy theories that may be harmless when ordinary citizens believe them, but can be a lot more dangerous when those in power act on those beliefs. And joining us now is Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Robert Baer is now an intelligence analyst at CNN. He's also the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks for having me back.
And it does seem that it's all been inevitable. There are four destroyers off the Syrian coast now with their cruise missiles, and apparently President Obama's, most of his team, the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of State, Chief of Staff, they're all weighing in, as are the British government, the French government, that the red line's being crossed and you have to respond to the use of weapons of mass destruction. Apparently, the only dissenting voices are coming from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Is this your understanding of where things stand?
Well, as of today, it looks that way. I mean, they've been making some fairly bellicose statements. And, you know, the president has put his reputation again on the line by saying, if this red line of chemical weapons is crossed and clearly crossed, I'm going to do something. You know, whether he's talked himself into a corner or it's been decided it's of our strategic interest to do this, I don't know. But I think we're a lot closer.
Well, what do you make of reports that the shelling of this suburb of Damascus, where the casualties came from, clearly not from trauma, but from the bodies and women and children would indicate that people died from other causes as opposed to, you know, the trauma of battle. The reports now are that the shelling came from Assad, the brother of Bashar Assad, who heads up the 4th Division, the Republican Guards, came from their lines. Is it possible that the brother, who's always been fairly quixotic and somewhat psychotic from reports that I've read, has he gone off the reservation?
Oh, I think that's possible. You know, Bashar was not truly the chosen designator, you know, the enfant, you know, of Hafez al-Assad, the successor. That boy died in a car accident, and he was an ophthalmologist and wasn't prepared for the role, and he was sent to the military academy. But, you know, whether he has a true control of the military, we just don't know. I mean, I'm agnostic on that. So, yes, it is possible, to answer your question, that Syria, the Alawites, could be falling apart, you know, in the sense that they're not following the president. Yes, it's absolutely possible. And then you have the Shabiha, which is the militias. Did they get a hold of shells? Did they fire them from Maher's position? I just don't know. You know, reports coming out of the front like this, it's hard to verify.
Well, it seems, though, that that the U.S. may not even wait for this U.N. inspection team to get in there. Russia, of course, is demanding that they do wait for this, and it seems that the clock is ticking. Is that the feeling you get?
Well, I think it is. And, you know, let's take the administration's point of view. I mean, can they stand by there where there's a Rwanda-like genocide going on in Syria and that all it'll carry with it, or do they have to do something? I mean, you know, if in fact the Syrians did fire these chemical weapons, what's to stop them from keep firing them, you know, if we don't do anything? And that's certainly a consideration in Washington right now. You know, on the other hand, I'm quite certain that they don't see a clear outcome to this at all. I mean, this is almost a symbolic gesture hitting Syria. I mean, I don't think it'll stop the Alawites from slaughtering people simply because they're a minority with their back against the wall. And they think that if they don't fight back with everything they have, they're all going to die. You know, whether true or not, it just doesn't matter. That's what they believe.
But Robert Baer, how can a political use of force, which this will presumably will be, it won't be a military use of force in as much as there's no way, one, the U.S. Can change the outcome of this battle, and two, I don't think they particularly want to, and obviously the reluctance on the part of General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, indicates that that's the kind of advice the military are giving the president. So, what is the utility of a political use of force? I mean, are there any examples that we can look at that where it worked?
Well, they're looking at Kosovo when they bombed the Serbs and to hold that back. But that was an entirely different, you know, situation. You can't compare Syria to Serbia. And I think they're casting around, you know, the pundits in Washington. I just haven't seen a reasonable solution, either on paper or anybody talking on TV or anything that's leaked out of government. And I keep in touch with these people that are making policy on Syria. And what worries me a little bit is when they ask me questions. I mean, they're trying to learn. They really are. They haven't made up their minds. We're not talking about an arrogant bunch. We've simply entered uncharted waters on the Arab Spring and everything going on in the Middle East. And you can count on it. We're going to make a lot of mistakes the next couple of years.
Well, always in this situation has been the wild card of Israel, who have struck at least, I think, four times against Assad for what they believe was the transfer of sophisticated weaponry to Hezbollah. And as you know, Hezbollah have entered the battle into Syria itself, and that's had severe repercussions in Lebanon itself, where you've had a tit-for-tat terrorist bombing first against the Hezbollah and then a retaliation in Tripoli against a Sunni cleric. So that could spin out of control. But my understanding has always been that there are a lot of people in the Israeli Defense Forces that would like to pay back Hezbollah for the inconclusive 2006 war, and Israel certainly poised in a good position given how distracted Hezbollah is and how deeply the Iranians and Hezbollah are being drawn into Syria. So do you consider that a likelihood?
Ian, I think they're at a loss too. I mean, you know, they live in a very tough neighborhood. It's getting a lot tougher. And they're looking at past wars to fight this current one. And, you know, I think right now, if any time in the world we need Tehran to see reason and talk to, it's now. The last thing we should do is be talking about, you know, bombing the one country that's still a country in the Middle East. So I don't really trust them on this. You know, they are reacting to the situation as well. They don't know what to do. And, of course, they have a lot higher stakes than we do. But I think going after Hezbollah now and starting some sort of, you know, full-on war in Lebanon isn't going to help them either. But, you know, you're going to have to wait to see when that starts. And I think we're a lot closer with the bombings in Tripoli on Friday. That was That's not happened in a long time in Lebanon. And so the sectarian divisions are spreading rather than being contained.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. He's now an intelligence analyst at CNN and is also the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. So the only sort of logical explanation for the U.S. and the West's strategy, for the want of a better description, in Syria has been that, you know, recalling Henry Kissinger's famous remark during the Iran-Iraq war that it's a pity both sides can't lose, that in effect we've just been waiting for them to beat the hell out of each other until they get exhausted. And that seems to be the way it's going. And there may be also a cynical strategy to draw the Iranians in because it's costing them a lot. And it could, you know, there's even been some talk that this could, Syria could be Iran's Vietnam. But I think this use of WMD, if it's indeed the case, surely changes that arrangement. It's really no longer about the Syrian civil war. It's about laying down a marker on the use of WMD, isn't it?
Well, I think, yeah, it's all over the Middle East. I mean, these people are truly desperate. And to fire, you know, sarin or VX or whatever they fired into this neighborhood, whoever fired it is really has crossed the line. And it is becoming dangerous. And the longer these conflicts go on, whether it's Yemen or Syria or even Egypt, the more violent they're going to become and the more there's going to be a temptation to stop them. But the problem is I don't think you can. I mean, it's almost, we're facing a 30-year war here, and you've got to let it burn out with all the tragedy and loss of life. I know it sounds pessimistic. I just have not seen anybody offer up a plan.
So what do you think will be the response then to what appears to be an almost inevitable use of force if it's a punitive strike? I imagine the most likely target would be the main airport, wouldn't it, through which all of the Iranian equipment comes?
You know, Damascus Airport is still open. So what? You close it. You know, you can blow the palace in Damascus off the map. You know, it'd be easy. It's an easy target. You can hit the Air Force, but this is pretty much, you know, a war, a urban warfare, a lot of it. And it's a guerrilla warfare, both sides. And they'll keep fighting. We may feel better. You cannot take out the chemical weapons. They've been dispersed. We don't know which ones have been, you know, they're combined chemicals. We don't know whether they've been mixed. It could be a lot worse. There is no easy targeting except, as you said, the obvious one, the airports. Now, what I don't think, my opinion, is not going to stop Bashar al-Assad or whoever's running that country. They'll keep fighting.
And it's not likely that they will target the leadership, is it? I mean, that's been a suggestion, but if that's the case, I can't imagine that Bashar and his family or Maher are staying in their palaces. I mean, they're watching CNN too, right?
It's not these people. It's not the Assad family has misled the Alawites. You were talking about the Alawites, and now a lot of Christians as well support them, afraid of the rebels who have allied with al-Qaeda. So you're talking about much more than the leadership of Syria. You're talking about two communities, as well as Sunni Muslims who were afraid of al-Qaeda, too. So you're talking about the worst sort of civil war, that removing one leader isn't going to make any difference.
Well, but it started out, I recall, as a popular uprising against the Assads who have, you know, this has been basically their personal plantation, what, for 40-plus years. And they certainly overreacted and in effect helped create this rebellion. But then it's since morphed into this Al-Qaeda...
Well, see, they would give you an argument. The Alawites and the Christians would say, you know, we, you know, if we let democracy come, Al-Qaeda would have arrived, you know, by legitimate means, and we would have still lost our heads. And this is what you have to put in the context of using chemical weapons, is they truly believe that their lives, their existence is at stake, you know.
Well, it's probably an accurate belief, isn't it, given the rhetoric that's coming?
No, I don't think it is. I think Al-Qaeda, if they got a hold of an Alawite, they would, as they have, they've done this on, you can find this stuff on YouTube where they've cut their heads off. And they think the whole community will, that's their fate. Now, the question is, like, how could we possibly protect the Alawites from that sort of retribution if they were to give up power? And I don't think we could. We don't have the army to do it. You can't be deploying U.S. military for 6-7, you know, years at a time, these soldiers gone, and then say, hey, by the way, we've got a third war in the Middle East. We'd like you to go into Syria. It's not going to work without the draft.
But what about Turkey, for example, a country right next door that it's an Islamic country?
Turkey, this is an old story. Turkey and the Persians, and I mean Iran, are fighting over the souls of the Arabs. So they are not exactly helpful in this. A lot of the weapons are passing through Turkey to the Salafis, to Al-Qaeda, and the Iranians, of course, are arming the Alawites. So this is a proxy war on top of a civil war.
Well, the more we talk, the more it appears that the U.S. is right to be cautious, and the polls indicate that the American public are against the U.S. getting involved. That said, if there is going to be some bombing in the next few days, do you think that it's going to change the equation much? They'll just pound the rubble a bit and it'll just continue as is? Or will this be a game changer?
It won't be a game changer. What we risk is getting sucked into a quagmire of actually making it worse. And the worst job in Washington right now is probably Susan Rice's, saying, you know, got to do something. What is it? And she's meeting around the clock. But easy solution, none. I think they would admit that if they could.
So then I guess at the end of the day, it is then going to be a political gesture, military gesture, as opposed to a military gesture. Would that be your final thought?
It's going to be political. And I think we would all be well served if it works.
But you're pretty skeptical it will.
I would be totally surprised if it did. I see things deteriorating. I've been saying this for a year and a half.
Sure.
And people who have lived in that region are as pessimistic as I am. It's not because I'm, you know it better than anybody. It's just what they all say.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. He's now an intelligence analyst at CNN and is also the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. And the rest of the program we prepared for today will be at ianmasters.com in about an hour from now. And Alan Minsky is joining me in the studio here. And for the balance of the program here today, we're going to be offering up some premiums, but we're going to start out with a brand new premium, which has not been offered before. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with further analysis of the impending U.S. strike on Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Responses to Globalization's Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And apparently there are four U.S. Navy destroyers, the Mahn, the Barry, the Gravely, and the Ramage, that are in the Eastern Mediterranean. There is a sense now that the red line that may have been crossed earlier was crossed rather sort of blatantly this time. And do you believe that at the end of the day, this is more to do with WMD and crossing that threshold, or do you still see this in the context of the Syrian agony?
Look, this is about the crossing of a red line. It's a red line that President Obama set forth a year ago, essentially, on August 20th of 2012. And since then, there have been other suggestions that the Syrians had used weapons. But this is a real clear case of the use of chemical weapons. We don't know what it is, but some chemical agent was used. Otherwise, you would not have produced these many and these kinds of calamity or victims. Now, the question is that what the United States will and can only do is maybe punish the Syrians for using it, but that's the most it can do, in the sense that this is not going to be about overthrowing the Assad regime. The American administration is not interested in getting involved in a long drawn-out conflict in the region. It has resisted it for a very, very long time. So we should be looking at some kind of military action that will be punitive, but will be very limited.
Well, the reports are that the shelling came from where the 4th Division, Maha, the brother of Bashar al-Assad's group, and that there are some reports that this is a new compound that they mixed a little bit of sarin with riot gas. How much do you think this idea of these inspectors coming in, they're already in country and now they've been allowed to go there, and most people think that there's a delaying game going on in order for the evidence to degrade. But I spoke the other day with a chemical weapons specialist who was one of the UN inspectors in Iraq, and he said that there should be plenty of evidence from the pathology of the victims. That would tell you enough. So do you have any sense of where the evidence stands?
Oh, look, this is beyond above my pay scale. I mean,
sure.
Médecins Sans Frontières came out and said this was gas, and I'm not about to question, you know, doctors and experts on this. I don't know. I mean, I cannot, especially sitting here in Washington, there's no way for me to know one way or the other. I mean, you look at reports and you look at credible sources, and the question is, who would you trust? And in this particular case, I would say a reputable organization like Médecins Sans Frontières would be a group I would look to and show the UN inspectors if they find anything. Now, I understand that UN inspectors are not allowed by charter to say who fired or who used the weapons of mass destruction. All they can say is whether or not they have been employed. So that's going to be a little bit tricky. But it seems to me that whichever way you look at it, this was done by the Syrian military, because no one else can use this so much gas in such a short period of time. And it was clearly deliberate. It was done at the dawn hours. This is not the something that Iraq Tech units of Al-Qaeda or ISIS or al-Nusra can do. It doesn't seem like that's possible. That doesn't mean that Al-Qaeda is not a vicious organization or al-Nusra is not a vicious organization, but this was clearly done by the Syrian military. The question is, to me, what is very weird about this is why now? Why do they need to do now? Unless they were really preparing a major onslaught on the region to clear out the opposition from Damascus, it doesn't make sense. Because weapons of mass destruction like that scare people, and but they don't really change in situations like that the balance of power. I don't think so. The only time we know that it happened was during the Iran-Iraq war, when Saddam used it against the Iranians, but that was in the context of large battles where huge amounts were used.
Again, I'm speaking with Henri Bakke, Professor of International Relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. And is it possible, though, that, as you say, that, first of all, the polls indicate that the American people do not want another war, and they're reluctant to get involved in Syria, and the president has appeared to have expressed that same kind of reluctance over the years. But I talk often to the local coordinating committees, the English language spokesperson for the Syrian rebels. And of course, you know, obviously you have to take a lot of what's being said as propaganda. But on the other hand, the belief seems to be that if you went after the Assad family and knocked them off or humiliated them sufficiently, which I imagine would be tantamount to killing them, suddenly the whole house of cards would collapse and you'd have a new day in Syria.
Look, a lot of people are speculating. They don't know what the United States will do. I don't know what the United States will do either. But first of all, I do know one thing. It will not go after the Assad family. In large measure, I think it's because it's very, very difficult to pinpoint where they are. And we've been talking now for a few days about American military action. You think the Syrian leadership is waiting in their palaces and saying, oh, when will the Americans attack? And, you know, sitting in the dining room, you know, waiting for the Americans to attack. Everybody has been dispersed. The one good thing about talking in advance of a military strike is that many of the Iranian and Russian advisors that the Syrians have will have probably also gone underground, because the last thing we want to do is kill Russians and Iranians, because we don't want crisis with them. But if I was the administration, what I would do is I would do a limited strike to show that you cross the red line, you have to pay a price, but it should be a strike that will hurt. And what is it that would hurt the Syrians most at the moment? Since you can't go after the chemical weapons stockpiles, you don't know exactly where they are. Even if you do, there may be civilians around there, or you may spread the chemical agents into the air, which you don't want to do. So I would target two very specific targets. One is a military airport in Damascus, which is being used to resupply the Syrian army from Russia and Iran. And the other one is the facilities at Latakia port that are also being used to resupply the Syrian military. Now, that would put a dent in terms of the resupply efforts of the Syrians. Sure, they can repair all these things, but it's going to take some time. And I think that's all we can expect the United States to do, because everything else, the Syrians are now probably moving, hiding. You know, you can hit maybe Maher's headquarters. Okay, that's another target, but probably there won't be anybody in there. So this military action, you have to remember, is mostly political. It is not military. It's political in the sense that the United States administration will want to make a point. The point is, we will intervene when we say we'll intervene with the use of weapons of mass destruction. Because if the administration doesn't do it now, it will look very bad. I say this as somebody who has said from the beginning that we should not go into Syria in any shape, way, or form. But sometimes because there was a red line set by the administration, and I think it's the right thing to do, we need to respond and send a message. But it doesn't mean that the people who use the weapons of mass destruction will be punished. That is to say, if Maher ordered this, they won't get Maher, because Maher is hiding someplace. It's the same thing. It's true for Bashar. And you don't want to hit the family because children and women are not part of this. So all you can do is limited damage that will hinder the ability of the Syrian army to replenish itself. And if they do it again, then you will have to escalate. But the point has to be made. But this is a political strike. It is not a strike in the military sense.
Well, that would indicate probably what appears to be going on from press reports in the White House is that the National Security Advisor Susan Rice, the Secretary of State John Kerry, the Chief of Staff, everybody's, according to the press, weighing in on President Obama, saying you've got to use military action. And the person that's apparently dragging their heels is the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, would indicate that the military people don't think this is particularly wise, but the civilian people think it's necessary.
Right. I mean, the military is right insofar as there is a problem here, and that is to say, we hit them once or we hit them twice, but there is a downside to all of this, which is also why I've always been opposed to any military action in Syria, is that what happens the day after tomorrow? The day after tomorrow, Assad will still be there, and people around the world will say, well, you hit them, and you know they're still there. Why don't you finish the job? Why don't you continue? I mean, there will be a tendency around the world to now say that this is our problem. And so the president has to be he has to be crystal clear. He has to say, I said the use of chemical weapons will result in American action, and this is why I'm doing it. And I would, if I also was the United States, I would not engage other powers to do this. I would do it by myself. I mean, I think it's important to show that the United States alone is doing it, and I would not use any other militaries. I wouldn't use bases in Turkey. I would just use our stuff that's in the Mediterranean. There's enough things out there that we can do this. But there is that problem, which is why the president, from the beginning, has been very reluctant to get involved in Syria, because he doesn't want to own it. And there will be pressure. Unquestionably, there'll be pressure on him to try to give him Syria and ask him to fix it now that he has sent American forces in. He has used American weapons here. So it's going to be a balancing act at the end. He really has to give a speech explaining this that will leave no questions out there for people to ponder. It's going to have to be, it has to be crystal clear. But he has to say that this is a limited military action to demonstrate American resolve to stop the use of weapons of mass destruction in this day and age, in the 21st century. And he will also have to threaten that next time it's going to be worse. And so that there is a deterrent. It has been said. Now, the Russians are going to be really mad about this. I mean, the Russian policy so far in Syria has been trying to rub America's nose, if possible. I mean, they've really been trying to humiliate the United States. But this is going to put them now on a defensive. And there's not much they can do to counter an American strike. So, in a way, this is also a challenge to the Russians.
So, Henri Barki, just in closing, it's pretty clear that the British government, the French government, are ahead of the US in saying that the line has been crossed and military action is required, and strong force, I think, is the way the French described it. Is there any truth to the story that some time back, when Sarkozy was president of France facing an election which he subsequently lost, that he'd lobbied the White House along with the Saudis to strike the palace on Qassoum Mountain?
I don't know that.
Yeah.
There's no way for me to know that. But look, yes, the French and the British may be ahead of us at the moment, but let's remember one thing. It is the United States that will do this. They don't have the wherewithal to do it, one. Two, because we will do it, and it's okay for the administration to essentially say nothing at the moment, right? Because ultimately, action will speak louder than words. The fact that that the French and the British are ahead of us doesn't really mean much at the moment.
Well, Henri Barkey, I thank you very much for filling us in on what's likely to be the case here, and I appreciate it. Again, I've been speaking with Henri Barkey. He's professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, amongst them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Response to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the United States of Paranoia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us is Jesse Walker, who's a senior editor of Reason Magazine and Reason.com. He has written on topics ranging from pirate radio to copyright law to political paranoia. His articles have appeared in a number of publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Salon, and the New Republic. His latest book, just out, is The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jesse Walker.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And obviously, the United States in many ways was founded by, I don't know how whether you could call the Pilgrims paranoid, but they certainly had a rough time. They'd been kicked out of England and went to Holland, and then they found them even too fundamentalist there. They booted them back to England, and then they finally put them on these ships and sent them to the New World. When you say that paranoia doesn't just influence America, it defines it. Are you saying it's in the DNA?
Well, I don't want to suggest that America is, you know, more or less paranoid than other countries. I mean, I didn't do like a cross-cultural study, but I will say, just looking at, you know, American history, that you know, we've been paranoid since the beginning. I mean, I go back to the beginning of the colonial days. I mean, if there were written records of, you know, Native Americans, I would have, prior to then, I would have gotten into that as well. And certainly the Puritans came here with intense fears of, well, to begin with, of the Native Americans. I write a lot about the fears of Native American conspiracies, which ranged from just, you know, thinking that the different tribes were plotting together, all the way out to, you know, really absurd cosmic notions about Satan having settled the New World with pagans from the Old World because they were fleeing the spread of the gospel, and those pagans became the Native Americans, and he was guiding them in their attack on, you know, the white settlers, and so on and so on. And then, of course, they also turned the paranoia inward. I mean, most famously with the Salem witch trials, but there's these links even between the sort of fear of witches and the fear of Native Americans and the fear of Catholics. And there's a quote from Cotton Mather in here where he's sort of imagining all of the witches and the French Canadians and the Indians plotting together, and this being the source of the so-called invisible attacks that hit Salem.
Well, it's interesting then, you know, to flash forward a little bit to the Mormon religion, which has a lot of strange New World notions of the Messiah coming here in the period that he was AWOL, and the idea that, I mean, some of the stuff in their theology is, I guess, in many ways science fiction, and you've got Scientology here in Los Angeles, which is a big religious player. Is paranoia and religion an American phenomenon?
Well, yeah, I mean, religion is very central to the American experience, and frequently it gets wrapped up in conspiracy theories and fears of people who are different, you know. I mean, you mentioned the Mormons. There are, you know, conspiracy theories in Mormon tradition, like there was the so-called Secret Society of Gadianton. I might be butchering the pronunciation of that, that was supposed to be based in the wilderness and whose leader had sworn secret oaths and covenants to the devil. But even more than that, there were all these intense and strange conspiracy theories about the Mormons, because just as any sort of minority religion that comes along and looks different, and particularly if it has sort of a different pattern of, you know, families and sexual arrangements, will inspire all kinds of odd thoughts as well. And I actually get into a fair amount of detail in the book about these ideas of, Mormons involved, you know, white slavery, seizing women for their own uses, having, using mind control methods. It's almost, I quoted from a book called Female Life Among the Mormons, which was a bestseller in 1855, and which presents itself as the memoir of a woman who was hypnotized into marrying a Mormon elder, and is, you know, a fraud. It's not a genuine account. But there's a point in that book where the author asks another former Mormon how Joseph Smith managed to master Franz Mesmer's mind control methods before it came to America. And there's this whole story gets spun about how he bought the information from a German peddler and came here, and they were using it to build the Mormon harems. It's tales of, you know, Mormon assassinations and so on. It's a very, you know, odd. And I should also add one thing about 19th century Mormon life is that they were, at that point, closely associated with making economic cooperatives. So there's also this economic angle to a lot of the fear of the Mormons at that point, too.
And again, I'm speaking with Jesse Walker, who's a senior editor of Reason Magazine and Reason.com. He's written on topics ranging from pirate radio to copyright law to political paranoia, and his articles have appeared in a number of publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Salon, and the New Republic. And his latest book just out is The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. So politicians have clearly used conspiracy theories. You know, you pay due homage to Richard Hofstadter's groundbreaking work, The Paranoid Style of American Politics. How much do you think, for example, the Republicans who use the Bertha conspiracies, you know, the Donald Trumps and et al., do they believe that, or is that just taking a political hit?
It varies. I mean, obviously there are sincere believers, and obviously there are cynics. And I think maybe most important, there are people who are able to persuade themselves of something if it's useful to be believed. And a lot of people forget it, but the birther idea actually originated among the diehard supporters of Hillary Clinton, or first caught on, I should say, among the diehard supporters of Hillary Clinton during the 2008 primaries, when they were sort of hoping that this would be a way to defeat Obama without, you know, the pain of political persuasion. And then after she dropped out, that's when it sort of migrated rightwards, and conservatives leaped on it for the same reason. And obviously, I mean, there's some cynicism to that, but I think especially after it became kind of clear that there wasn't anything to the story, that nonetheless, people were able to keep persuading themselves of it. I don't see birtherism sort of surviving as a top-down phenomenon. I think it's sort of a grassroots thing among people who would like that to be true because it would make their agenda easier. And I should add also, because you mentioned Hofstetter, I mean, I give him credit for a couple of insights, but I criticize him as well, because I think that, I mean, I don't know how much you want to get into this, but I think his essay, which he wrote 50 years ago, was a product of its time, and you can see some, you know, bordering on paranoid elements in there as well, or if not in the essay, he was sort of partaking of some fears that were in the air. And in particular, he suggests that conspiracy theories, you know, what he calls the paranoid style, are a product of minority movements, meaning not, you know, racial minorities, but, you know, political minorities. And in fact, and this is a point I stress again and again since the beginning, the fear of conspiracies has been at the center, as well as, you know, the so-called extremes. The establishment has its own forms of political paranoia as well. They're often not called conspiracy theories because they're the conventional wisdom at the time. And you look back decades later and say, oh, when we were freaking out about homosexuals in the civil service in the early Cold War, that was actually a completely irrational conspiracy fear. But at the time, they're considered conventional wisdom and not called conspiracy theories. And I think that these are the sorts of, that's the sort of political paranoia that does the most damage, because when, you know, when something catches on among powerful people, I mean, by definition, if you have power, you can do more damage. That's what power is, right? You can do more. And I think that's worth stressing, and I think that was a point that Hofstetter missed.
Well, I think, though, that if you go back to the period that Hofstetter wrote it, and the McCarthy era, and I recall the famous joke by the comedian Mort Saul during the Cold War that the Russians arrested an American for spying and the U.S. retaliated by arresting an American for spying.
Right.
And that, in a sense, our paranoia creates our own nemesis, that the Stalin purge trials were almost identical to the House of Un-American Activities trials here in the United States. They asked the same question, are you not a communist?
A bit more destructive.
Yes.
You know, people died.
But, true, you were taken out in the back and shot, as opposed to have your career ruined. But, and then more recently, the response to Osama bin Laden has been this multi-trillion dollar war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Homeland Security, which has cost us about $1 trillion. And there's no cost-benefit analysis done. They just keep pouring more money at it.
And the fear becomes the justification for that. I should say, just breaking in, since you mentioned bin Laden, that I compare the way that his that the way that he is often presented in the press and all as a sort of, or was presented before he died, as a sort of terrorist CEO, you know, controlling this, you know, tightly hierarchical James Bond style, you know, global network of mayhem. I mean, for one thing, that's not what Al Qaeda was or is. You know, it's a loose network. At the time that it was tightly centralized, it wasn't large, and at the time it's large, it's not tightly centralized. But this echoes a lot of the ways that Indian chiefs, who are sort of, I mean, I quote another historian's phrase calling it the myth of the super chief, the way that, you know, people like Sitting Bull and Geronimo were perceived as master conspirators and portrayed that way in you know, popular rhetoric. And it's telling, I think, that when Osama bin Laden was, you know, finally killed, the code word that they relayed to say that the operation was completed was Geronimo. You know, it's just like one of those great moments of an idea echoing through American history.
Well, I think bin Laden himself, though, has suggested that he was hoping to trigger a paranoid reaction in the United States, and then that they would do the rest. They would ultimately do the damage to themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of gets back to the Mort Saul joke that you made.
Yeah, yeah. So what is it then, for example, you know, the 9/11 truth has always dogged me whenever I do public speaking engagements, etc. And it's sort of strange, their obsession with Building 7 and all of this mythology, that almost a religious mythology they built around the idea that Bush and Cheney, in order to rescue their failed presidency, somehow got 19 Arabs to fly these planes into buildings which were already wired with explosives, which makes you wonder why the hell they bothered to use the planes if they could already mine the buildings and demolish them on the ground. And
all of this.
The strangest theory is the one that claims that there wasn't a plane that hit the Pentagon, but then doesn't explain where the plane actually went. I don't know if you've heard or seen that one. But
Well, obviously they just go on and on, but I've talked to people like Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff, who was in the White House at the time, and what frustrates him is that the truthers have actually helped cover up 9/11 in the sense that Bush and Cheney were culpable, since their first responsibility is to protect and defend the United States, that they exposed the United States to reckless endangerment by not listening to the warnings that were coming from the intelligence people, etc. And that strikes me as an amazing irony, that the truthers are actually helping Bush and Cheney for, avoid what they're most afraid of, which is impeachment. And apparently, at least this is what Wilkerson tells me.
Yeah, although I don't think I don't think that the truthers are taken seriously enough among the people who make those decisions on impeachment to actually have that much influence. You know, the 9/11 truth movement comes up a couple times in this book, but in the end, I sort of feel like they're sort of a side attraction. That the really intense paranoia that or the most important paranoia that hit the country after 9/11. Was the kind we were talking about earlier that allowed all those, the wars and, you know, laws like the Patriot Act to be pushed through. And that's sort of symbolized by people who, you know, they saw a little sugar or a coffee sweetener spilled in an airport lounge, and they immediately assumed it's an anthrax attack. And I think that I will say this about the truth movement, I can understand the appeal of thinking that, you know, there's been this massive horrible thing that happens that kills these thousands of people, and that the best way to deal with it is just to remove the person that's in power in the United States. That seems like a much easier task than actually tackling the all the ways that, you know, the U.S. is interfering in other parts of the world and angering people and these hard to penetrate, you know, networks of people who are angry at the U.S. and just, you know, the mess of a problem that we were and are in. So I can certainly understand the appeal of that story, but I have never been convinced of it. One point I make in this book again and again is that even when a conspiracy story says absolutely nothing true about the object of the story, if it catches on, it says something true about the anxieties and the experiences of the people who believe it. So they're all worthy of study, and I look at a whole swath of them. I understand the sorts of anxieties that set off that kind of those theories. I just sometimes you can understand the anxieties, but not buy the theories.
So Jesse Walker, again, the author of a new book just out, The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. Our conspiracy theories, since they do seem to have a religious connotation, or at least a religious intensity, are they also the result of kind of intellectual laziness? Because in the real world, intentions create outcomes. But in conspiracy land, outcomes create intentions. In other words, you just retroactively decide who benefited from an act or a trauma like 9/11, and then the trail leads you immediately to Bush and Cheney.
I would say that is true of lazy conspiracy theories. Conspiracies do happen. People conspire, right? I have a chapter in the book that talks about, you know, the Church Committee investigations and the genuine abuses in the intelligence community that were exposed, COINTELPRO and MKUltra and so on. I've known, you know, conspiracy theorists who are open to new evidence and don't fall into that sort of religious belief that you're talking about. So what you're saying there isn't so much the I don't think that's true of, you know, anyone who believes in conspiracies. I think it's true of a certain sort of conspiracy believer. And for that matter, a certain sort of believer in stuff that isn't conspiracy. I mean, it has to do with sort of the psychology of belief, you know. There are folks who like to dig in their heels and ignore contrary evidence.
Well, but you can see why people are tempted. I mean, for example, if I were to ask you, back in the Reagan administration, who would most benefit from the assassination of Ronald Reagan? The answer would be the vice president, because he'd become president. And then if I told you that George and H.W. and Barbara Bush's closest friends were the parents of Hinckley, then if you're a conspiracy theorist, you'd immediately connect the dots, you know. Michael Hastings, who the journalist who died somewhat mysteriously in the car wreck here in Los Angeles, which is still a lot of people have questions about, his forthcoming article in the Rolling Stone is a profile on the new head of the CIA. So a guy writes a story about the head of the CIA and ends up in a fiery car wreck. Slam dunk.
Yeah, I mean, and I haven't been persuaded by any Hastings theories, but then again, as of yet, but I should say that, you know, I didn't write this book as sort of an attack on, you know, conspiracy believers, and I didn't write it. When I think something is wrong, I say so, but it's really just sort of looking at the stories, looking at the folklore, so sort of seeing this, this sort of American history as a sort of panorama of fears that people have had, and focusing especially on, you know, conspiracy beliefs by people in power, not just outsiders looking in. So I don't fault anyone for, you know, suspecting a conspiracy or investigating a conspiracy. I think there's a problem when, as you said, somebody just sort of thinks qui bono is all you need to ask, you know, that, you know, once you've established that someone has a motive, you don't have to then take the next step and prove the case, which has been, I mean, you know, that there are, during the American Revolution, that was sort of a typical, you know, approach to, the colonies were rife with conspiracy theories by the colonists about the British and by the British and their agents here, by the loyalists about the rebels. And there's, if you read the Declaration of Independence, it is, you know, arguably a conspiracy theory. It's not just saying these are all the bad things the king has done. It's arguing that this is a deliberate plot to undermine, you know, the liberties of people in the English colonies. And what is their evidence for that? It basically amounts to what you were saying, that because these things are being done and have the effect of reducing people's liberties, therefore the reason for it must be a plot to remove our liberties. Meanwhile, if you look at what the English themselves were thinking, they weren't talking among themselves about how can we, you know, crush, you know, the colonies into, and make them our slaves. They're imagining all these conspiracies among the rebels and wondering if the French are putting them up to it and so on. So, I mean, the sort of mentality you're talking about is very, very old.
Well, Jesse Walker, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jesse Walker, who's a senior editor of Reason Magazine and Reason.com. He has written on topics ranging from pirate radio to copyright law to political paranoia, and his articles have appeared in a number of publications, including The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, Salon, and The New Republic. His latest book just out is The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michael Scherzer. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.